to be avoided if humanly possible. What was that other door? Conceal is what it read to my eyes. On behalf of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, an organization whose success relies on the public trust, I had testified under oath in public hearings to Congress and the American people that this case was finished. Now I knew that was no longer true. To remain silent at this point, while taking the step of getting a search warrant to review thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails, including possibly the missing early emails, would be an affirmative act of concealment, which would mean the director of the FBI had misled and was continuing to mislead Congress and the American people. Speak or conceal, both terrible options. The mid-year senior team debated them both. We talked, then broke so people could think, then we talked again. We sat around my conference table and looked at it from every direction we could think of. My chief of staff, Jim Rybicki, took his normal seat at the opposite end of the oblong table from me, so he could quietly watch all the participants and their body language. His job was to make sure I was hearing from everyone, with nothing held back. He has unusual emotional intelligence, and if he saw something concerning, someone hesitating or being talked over, he would speak to the person privately and alert me, so I could draw that person into a later discussion. The FBI's general counsel, Jim Baker, played a similar role. He was a long-time and wise friend, and I could count on him to bring arguments and concerns to me if they weren't being adequately voiced. He would often come to me privately and play devil's advocate because he knew we needed every view, every concern, every argument. We made arguments against our arguments, but even with a dozen perspectives, we kept coming back to the same place. The credibility of the institutions of justice was at stake. Assuming, as nearly everyone did, that Hillary Clinton would be elected President of the United States in less than 2 weeks, what would happen to the FBI, the Justice Department, or her own presidency if it later was revealed, after the fact, that she was still a subject of an FBI investigation? What if, after the election, we actually found information that demonstrated prosecutable criminal activity? No matter what we found, that act of concealment would be catastrophic to the integrity of the FBI and the Department of Justice. Put that way, the choice between a really bad option and a catastrophic option was not that hard a call. We had to tell Congress that things had changed. As we were arriving at this decision, one of the lawyers on the team asked a searing question. She was a brilliant and quiet person whom I sometimes had to invite into the conversation. "Should you consider that what you're about to do may help elect Donald Trump president?" she asked. I paused for several seconds. It was, of course, the question that was on everyone's mind, whether they expressed it out loud or not. I began my reply by thanking her for that question. "It's a great question," I said. "But not for a moment can I consider it, because down that path lies the death of the FBI as an independent force in American life. If we start making decisions based on whose political fortunes will be affected, we are lost." In other words, if we at the FBI started to think like every other partisan in Washington thought, what's good for my side, or whose political futures we might help or hurt, then the FBI would no longer have, and would no longer deserve, the public trust. The reservoir would be empty. I instructed the team to tell the senior staff at Justice that I believed it was my duty to inform Congress that we were restarting the investigation. I would say as little as possible, but the FBI had to speak. I said I would be happy to discuss the matter with the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General. I'm not sure exactly why I opened the door to them in a way I hadn't in July. I think part of it was a human reaction. I had taken an enormous amount of criticism for freezing them out in July. Part of it was also that I thought they would see the issue as I did and support me in what was to be a brutal situation. After all, the Attorney General had publicly testified in July that the email investigation had been done well and was complete. Now her own prosecutors were seeking a search warrant. Surely she would see that concealing that would be dishonest and a catastrophe for the Department of Justice. but through their staffs, Lynch and Yates communicated that they thought this was a bad idea, that they would advise against it, but that it was my call, and they didn't see a need to speak with me about it. They didn't order me not to do it, an order I would have followed. They didn't want to choose a door, speak or conceal. After I got this answer, I briefly toyed with the idea of communicating to them that I decided not to tell Congress, just to see what they would do if I shifted the responsibility entirely to them, but decided that would be cowardly and stupid. Once again, it became my responsibility to take the hit. I told the mid-year team to offer Justice the chance to review my draft letter to Congress and suggest any changes. They took that opportunity, and, while preserving their advice against my doing it, offered some useful suggestions for how to describe what was going on, and in just a few sentences. On Friday morning, October 28th, which oddly enough stuck in my head as the 39th anniversary of the Ramsey rapist attack, I sent the letter to the chairpersons and the ranking members of each committee to which the Bureau had provided information in the wake of the completion of the Clinton email investigation. As I did in July, I again emailed the entire FBI workforce about what was happening.